Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back, Dilemmas of the Modern Fan, by Jessica Luther and Kavitha A. Davidson, narrated by Michelle Williams. Introduction. We know why you are here, listening to this right now. You love sports like we do. But like us, you often feel like sports don't love you back. But, and here's the real hurt, you don't know how to quit them. You are, instead, searching constantly for that middle space that allows you to quiet your conscience and indulge your fandom. Sports are a big business, and with that comes the dirtiness of any major money-making thing that holds cultural significance. You know that college athletes are exploited for their labor, but you also really love the roller coaster of March Madness. You are aware that violent hits to the head on the football field mean the players are sacrificing their bodies and brains, and sometimes they carry that violence off the field into their personal lives. Still, you love tailgating, and a good hard tackle is, well, a good hard tackle. You get that the mascot of your team is a racist caricature of a native person, but you've loved this team your whole life, long before you became aware of the mascot's problems. You understand why athletes are using their platforms to advocate for change within and beyond sports. But couldn't they just play the game you came here to see and give you a break from the ills of the world for a couple of hours? Welcome to our club for sports fans who care too much. It's exhausting here, but we can't leave. We don't want to. Being a sports fan is often tiring. Part of what makes sports so wonderful is that you get to participate in a huge emotional journey during every match and throughout a season, year after year. You can choose a side, root for a player or a team, feel the highs and lows of their heroics, cry with joy or sadness at the wins and losses. Still, and we're going to be frank about this, the world of sports has long been an exclusionary space. Barring athletes of color and or women and or LGBTQ+ athletes from competing. If these athletes do find a way into this exclusive part of our culture, they face harassment and often suffer from a lack of resources. Any attempt they make to force sports to be more inclusive is branded negatively as bringing politics into games, casting blame upon those who are excluded for drawing attention to how the system was created and is maintained unfairly, rather than turning the spotlight on those who built the system and thrive within its strictures. This exclusion bleeds over into fandom. There are certain people in our culture who are expected to be interested in sports, if not authorities on all things sports-related. Others, not so much. Take, for example, the woman fan, who not only has to constantly swear on some holy book to the disbelievers, mainly men, that she actually cares about sports, but who also is quizzed about her knowledge to prove it. The flip side of this is the man who cares not at all about sports. Jessica's husband doesn't follow sports, other than checking in to understand what she is watching or reporting on. He begs off the sports talk with other men, telling them to talk to his wife instead. Similarly, whenever Kavitha is at a bar watching sports, men who don't know that she's a sports writer are often surprised to hear her comment on the game. Surprised not just that she's knowledgeable, but that she's even interested in the first place. And if a patron asks the bartender something about sports, they immediately defer to Kavitha, much to the surprise of the guy asking the question. Beyond that, and perhaps more crucially, plenty of sports fans who are black or brown and or women and or LGBTQ+ and or from other marginal groups have played sports in peewee leagues as children or on high school teams or on intramural or recreational teams, and they've experienced discrimination or bigotry as an athlete. When these fans watch collegiate or professional or international sports, they see the same forces at work, just with more prestige, money, and media behind it all. They also see the injustices present throughout our society reflected back in the sports they care about. Players yelling homophobic slurs at opposing players on the pitch. Male athletes being marketed exhaustively and paid 100 times more than women athletes. White owners, a loaded term if there ever was one given the racial makeup of America's most profitable sports leagues, exploiting the labor and bodies of black players. Fans love sports, but it's unclear if sports love them back. You love sports, but do sports love you back? This is the ultimate truth about the long history and the current state of sports and politics. As Kavitha once wrote for ESPNW, when you think about it really, the division between sports and politics has long been eroded. The separation is what takes effort to uphold, and it's mostly done by people whose right to exist in this space isn't questioned. The stick to sports mantra has been repeated time and again by fans who view sports as a form of pure escapism, which is understandable. But the reality for many fans and players is that sticking to sports has never really been an option, particularly for people whose mere participation in competition can be seen as a radical act in itself. This also belies history. Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals at the 1936 Summer Olympics in Berlin and upended Hitler's plans to use the Games as a showcase for the supremacy of the Nazi agenda and the Aryan race. John Carlos and Tommy Smith raised their fists on the medal podium at the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City, creating one of the most indelible images in sports and in civil rights history. And the legendary matchup of the underdogs versus Titans at the 1980 Winter Games in Lake Placid between the U.S. men's hockey team and Russia, the Miracle on Ice, became a proxy battle during the Cold War. And so, when the International Olympic Committee, IOC, specifically banned protests, including kneeling and hand gestures, ahead of the Tokyo Summer Olympics, it did so with the intent of upholding sports as an arena of unity, with little acknowledgement of how sports has sowed division. The U.S. women's soccer star Megan Rapinoe's response to this directive, "We will not be silenced." The chapters in this book represent separate moral dilemmas that get at different features of people's sensitivities, whether it's race, gender, class, and trying to minimalize it so you can stay consistent with your team's sport, says Dr. Susan K. Whitburn, a developmental psychologist and professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who is an expert on the psychology of sports fandom. In the broadest sense, this is cognitive dissonance writ large. You've got competing sets of attitudes, values, and behavior. And in the worst-case scenario, she offers, everything is in conflict, and individual team members are engaging in bad behavior that you cannot condone, and then you try to somehow come up with a way to rationalize it. People are willing to suspend disbelief to allow their identification as a fan to continue unsullied. To be sure, cognitive dissonance isn't unique to sports. It's something music and film fans struggle with, too. It's just more intense in sports because of all the other things about fandom. Whitburn contends things like pride in our communities, or early memories of our first game with our grandparents, or the emotional highs and lows of a back-and-forth game. Because sports allegiances are largely built early in life, they're not only harder to break, but also more ingrained in who we are and where we come from. It depends on where the core of your identity is coming from, and for sports, it's huge, she says. And it's partly, I think, because the fandom does develop at a time that people are starting to form their sense of identity. I tend to think that some of this, and I'm using the word carefully, is inherited, not genetically, obviously, but you absorb it from your family. I know that the origins of a lot of fandom is that it's associated with family events, family culture. And so then that becomes kind of a defining set of events within your family at a time when you're growing up. And the traits we inherit from our families can be good or bad, positive or negative, healthy or unhealthy. These traits can include positive, healthy attitudes toward fandom, such as rooting for the home team, or negative, unhealthy attitudes toward fundamental aspects of sports in the modern age, begrudging women's participation in traditionally male sports, for example, or expressing outright prejudice toward LGBTQ+ athletes. Thus, the way we tolerate sports is akin to the way we tolerate family members, because sports are, as Whitburn tells us, so closely linked to family. In some cases, our teams even feel like family. Moreover, the inherent nature of watching sports, the ebbs and flows of a game and of a season, contributes to this difficulty. The difference between sports and everything else is that the outcome, as Whitburn says, is not predetermined in a game, and so that unpredictability arouses the emotions more and means that the outcome will bring you up or bring you down that much more. For some sports fans, winning versus losing actually is the difference between a happy and an unhappy day, week, month, year, or decade. Similarly, the thought process of denial is hardwired into sports fans even before any moral considerations come into play. Whitburn explains it this way. I think sports fans are pretty good at denial. I mean, in a way, you kind of practice it because it's very adaptive, because then you can always look for a million excuses as to why your team lost, rather than you having to confront it. So you're kind of rewarded for using denial because it's so much a part of being a sports fan. This book is about embracing that such denial exists and figuring out what to do with it. It's about the intersections between sports and politics, sports and culture, sports and our own identities, sports and the ills of our world. We want to sit in those intersections, interrogate the status quos, and question how we, all of us, whether you are a casual or a diehard sports fan, should respond. Where and how do we draw the lines, especially as a fan who often feels unloved by our beloved sports? Each chapter in this book tackles, get it, a different issue within sports. Not every issue and not every sport is represented. We are human, and there is only so much time in a day. But we hope you can pull from this book different ways to think more critically and deeply about these games we all spend so much time watching and about which we care so much. Many of the issues we discuss in tennis can be applied to, say, golf, and the dilemmas football fans face when it comes to brain injury are also felt by fans of boxing and hockey. Every town with a publicly funded stadium has felt the political and economic pressures that come with building that facility, and every fan has a bone to pick with their owner. Also, we admit that this book is not full of solutions. Sorry. If we had the answers to the major systemic problems we discuss in this book, racism, sexism, homophobia, class inequities, among others, that would be a hell of a get. Truth be told, there is no single solution for how to be a sports fan, because there is no single sports fan. We all contribute different identities and experiences to fandom. Each of us meets these moral dilemmas in distinct ways. Sometimes we ignore them, and sometimes we leave them behind. Often we may find ourselves somewhere in between. Finally, we want to acknowledge that this book was drafted in the years leading up to the COVID-19 pandemic, and it went to print while much of the world was still on lockdown in an attempt to stop the virus spread. We are not sure what the world, much less sports, will look like in the next few weeks, months, and even years. We believe that makes this book more important than ever. It was not lost on us that the pandemic touching sports is precisely what made this real to a lot of people in the United States. Businesses didn't start to close, cities didn't start shutting down, this didn't register nationally until the NBA decided to suspend play after Utah Jazz center Rudy Gobert tested positive for COVID-19. And as the pandemic has unfolded, there have been discussions about inequity in healthcare, as baseball players debated getting elective Tommy John surgery at a time when many couldn't access basic medical care. Stephen Curry used his Instagram account to do a live interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Megan Rapinoe and Sue Bird's quarantine videos were a needed relief for those of us stuck at home, and sports equipment companies like Bauer, New Balance, and Formula One's Mercedes retrofitted their factories to produce personal protective equipment for frontline workers. If you step back to take the 30,000-foot view, the COVID-19 crisis has amplified the idea that sports are not just sports and can never be. Perhaps some details in this book will change when sports reemerge post-pandemic, but the systemic issues we address here are not going away. If anything, we are worried that in a fervor to get back to sports in whatever way we can, people will be less critical of the teams, leagues, institutions, and organizations that bring sports to them. What will that mean for the under-resourced or marginalized athletes, for women's sports, for how sports get covered and who covers it, for pro-labor stances, or for the anger against politics and sports? In short, what will it mean for those who already feel that sports do not love them back? We hope this book starts conversations. We hope it inspires you to reassess how you think about sports. More than anything, we hope it helps you figure out how, or even if, you can love sports when sports don't love you back. Chapter 1. Watching football when we know, even a little, about brain trauma. On December 10, 2017, the NFL's Houston Texans hosted the San Francisco 49ers. In the second quarter, 49ers linebacker Elvis Dumervil brought opposing quarterback Tom Savage down hard. Savage's head bounced off the ground. The TV cameras then caught Savage rolling onto his left side, his arms held perpendicular to his body, both of them shaking. This involuntary arm spasming is known as the fencing response, which happens immediately after a brain injury and is a telltale sign of a concussion. There were reports that he even spit up blood. Savage was checked by the medical team and then, who knows why, returned to the game for a three-and-out series during which he threw two incompletions. When the Texans' next offensive series came up, he fought to go back on the field but was denied. It's hard to understand why this NFL moment mattered more than others. It wasn't the time Carolina Panthers quarterback Cam Newton took four helmet-to-helmet hits in a September 2016 game against the Broncos. It wasn't when the Dolphins' Matt Moore took a hard helmet hit into his jaw in January 2017. That was the kind of hit that takes your breath away as a spectator, and one from which it took Moore minutes to get up off the field. He quickly returned to play, and the team was later chastised, though not punished, by the NFL for missing the fact that Moore had been bleeding from his mouth. It wasn't even when the same Tom Savage, a week before Moore's hit and 11 months before he seized on the field, got clocked on a quarterback sneak. Savage was pulled off the field and was immediately met by the athletic trainer. After being evaluated in the locker room, you know where this is going, he returned for one play, where he took the snap and then a knee to end the half. Savage was re-evaluated at halftime and pulled from any further action in that game. It must have been the visible seizure in December 2017 that did it. Whatever it was, this time mattered. The NFL announced only a couple weeks later that the league was updating its concussion protocol, including a new rule that players like Savage, who had a seizure or similar response to a hit, must leave the game and cannot return. It's a wonder that there needed to be an actual protocol in place to know that a seizure on the field is not, in fact, okay. As Sports Illustrated pointed out in 2016, in the section of the NFL Game Operation Manual that describes the concussion protocol, the words "clear visual evidence" appear in bold. The referee saw it, he was standing right there, and ran over to check on Savage. We all saw it. We all see it every week on the football field, in fact. If you think about it at all, you realize that we see it in so many places, on the soccer pitch, in the big surfing waves, during BMX or snowboarding events, at cheerleading competitions, in hockey games, in the boxing ring, and on the lacrosse field. Cyclists sustain the most concussions, hands down. We know these head injuries are objectively bad. We understand that football, especially at the professional level, is dangerous to athletes' brains. We know that collisions cause concussions and are part of sports, especially popular contact sports, football, boxing, hockey. And anyone can see that what happened to Savage is bad. But how bad? What can we do to protect players both on and off the field? And if we can't protect them well enough, then what should we do? There are two ways we often talk about traumatic brain injuries, TBIs, concussions, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. These are really only two parts of a larger spectrum. CTE is a neurodegenerative disease that probably is at one far end of "here's the worst stuff that can happen to you," says Patrick Ruby, a sports writer who has covered brain trauma for so long and in such depth that it's safe to call him an expert on this topic. But on the other end, it could be like, maybe you get a concussion, then you recover, and you're okay. But it also knocks you out of school for a semester, and your grades plummet, and you deal with some depression. Concussions are mild TBIs. Imagine your head is an egg, the brain, the yolk. No helmet will save you from brain damage because that's not the point of a helmet. They're great at preventing skull fractures, Ruby says, but they can't protect that yolk from getting swirled. I could put a steel cube around an eggshell and you wouldn't be able to punch the shell and break it, he says, but the yolk still shakes when it moves. Sometimes there are obvious symptoms, such as the fencing response, vomiting, and headaches. Or perhaps the person is dazed, their movements are clumsy, they feel dizzy, they are sensitive to light or noise, or they pass out. Sometimes the symptoms take a while to present and can persist. Things like fatigue, confusion, difficulty remembering, or difficulty concentrating may cause significant problems in the short term or long term. On top of that, there can be damage without any outward indicators. Subconcussive hits can happen from repeated hits to the head, but it's hard to know that they are happening or even their long-term impact because they don't produce concussions or concussion-like symptoms. All of this together, concussive and subconcussive hits, can lead to CTE, which Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center believes is caused by repetitive brain trauma. That's not to say that if you suffer repetitive brain trauma that you will get CTE. It's a possibility, and a bad one. The symptoms of CTE, the CTE Center says, include memory loss, confusion, impaired judgment, impulse control problems, aggression, depression, anxiety, suicidality, Parkinsonism, and eventually progressive dementia. You often don't start showing signs until well after you've suffered the TBIs, and there is currently no way to diagnose CTE while you are alive. It takes a post-mortem study of the brain to do that. It's worth noting the use of the word "believe" in the CTE Center's description of what causes CTE. Despite all the scrutiny around brain trauma in sports since the early 2000s, there is still so much we don't know. In July 2017, the New York Times published a beautiful, scary piece about a study by Dr. Anne McKee, director of BU's CTE Center. McKee had examined the brains of 202 football players. Of the 202 football players, 111 of them played in the NFL, and 110 of those were found to have CTE. The brains here are from players who died as young as 23, and as old as 89. And they are from every position on the field, quarterbacks, running backs, and linebackers, and even a place kicker and a punter. This is damning, but it's also hard to contextualize because many of the brains that end up on the keys table are from players whose families thought their loved ones showed symptoms of CTE while alive. If only those who seem to have CTE are donating brains, then the brains studied are likely to have CTE. The answer is that we need more science. But sports organizations fear just that. If science proves that the sports these organizations oversee are directly responsible for brain degeneration, then they could be held legally liable. For example, the NFL has historically been at odds with scientists. In 2012, the league donated $30 million to the National Institutes of Health as an unrestricted gift. In the press release, the league stated that this money could very well fund research into CTE concussions, and the understanding of the potential relationship between traumatic brain injury and late-life neurodegenerative disorders, especially Alzheimer's disease. 4 years later, a congressional committee found that the NFL attempted to influence how the money was spent in order to steer funding away from one of its critics. The science is happening, though, and well beyond Boston University. Don Comstock is a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Colorado School of Public Health. She has run the National High School Sports-Related Injury Surveillance System for more than a decade. It is modeled after the one the National Collegiate Athletic Association, NCAA, runs on the collegiate level. It tallies weekly reports from athletic trainers across the country, which include any injury sustained by an athlete during the week and include the athlete's age, height, weight, and what position he or she plays, as well as the severity of the injury, where it occurred on the athlete's body, and the final diagnosis. Trainers also take note of the location of the injury event, the amount of time the student has to rest, and whether the injury occurred during practice or competition, which is taken into account along with the total number of practices and competitions during the week. From this system, Comstock and her colleagues gather data about concussions, which athletes get them, their symptoms, how they are managed after suffering a concussion, and how long their recovery takes. Part of the ongoing struggle to understand the frequency and severity of concussions and other TBIs is that we have no nationwide way to monitor and study them. This is why, Comstock says, discussions about concussions often fall within the sports realm. Between her high school surveillance system and the NCAA's collegiate one, there is data to look at, pore over, compare and contrast, and study. We should be just as concerned with the health of the high school student that slipped and fell on an icy sidewalk or who was in a car crash as we should be about the football player or the ice hockey player. Unfortunately, almost all of the national attention on concussions over the last decade has been centered on sports. What we have learned since public scrutiny has been focused on concussions is that the more aware people are of brain trauma, the more likely they are to report it. We probably don't have that many more kids getting concussions today than we did in 2005, Comstock says, but those kids who are getting a concussion today are much more likely to come to the attention of medical providers. Overall, Comstock thinks things are getting better. Even though concussion rates have gone up, we've seen a much broader array of symptoms being reported, which indicates that people are much more knowledgeable about what constitutes concussion signs and symptoms, and we've seen more appropriate clinical care of the student athletes with regards to when they're allowed to return to play. One area that needs more work is the gender differences in concussion reporting and recovery. Comstock says that, in every single study, consistently females have higher concussion rates than males. But she cautions that if anyone tries to tell you that they know why this is true, then they are lying to you. It probably falls into a combination of two different factors. It could truly be biophysiological, meaning that there's something about the female body compared to the male body that means that females really are at increased risk. But Comstock says even those biophysiological reasons could be traced more to the strength of any given individual's neck muscles. What else could explain it? Undoubtedly, there are also sociocultural issues going on. There's a ton of really good research out there that says women...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?